Hi, Peter.
Hi, Serge.
So you've been very interested in how neuroscience can give us some perspectives in understanding the felt sense.
Yes, it gives us a different perspective from what we are used to in terms of understanding felt sense from what Jean Gendlin has written and said about it and our personal experience of it. And I suppose the general philosophical approach that starts with Gendlin and then has followed on from him. So the neuroscience viewpoint is obviously quite different, but I think it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think it can support and it supports the the general and philosophical personal experience of the felt sense, I think, but it also brings up the question, it's a kind of theoretical question, which is at the heart of what I want to say here, which is that it raises a question of if we go more into our felt sense experience, so we're aware of that level of experience inside ourselves that we call felt sense, then what we might expect, thinking in neuroscience terms, is that it would change the way that we implicitly relate and communicate with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So that the very inward intrapersonal practice of focusing has a bearing on the interpersonal practice and general living of relating and communicating with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that kind of, it's this kind of dichotomy that or contrast of inner and outer relationships that I'm particularly interested in.
Yeah. So that contrast of inner and outer relationship, and that in our experience as focusers, we would tend to describe focusing process as paying attention to what happens inside. Mm-hmm. And yet, by doing this, what happens is it actually also changes the way we relate to the outside world.
Well, from the first point of view, we might think, we might expect that it would. So we could then go and see whether that seems to be borne out in reality. And of course, we can look at this from a personal experience point of view and say, well, how have I changed, and how have people, do people I know, how have I observed them change, you know, over a period of time in practicing focusing in terms of how we relate outwardly when we're not sitting down to do focusing together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So of course that's what we can empirically observe in our own lives and the lives of other focusers. But there is also something that you've been paying a lot of attention to is in the perspectives that neuroscience gives us of how the brain functions, and specifically how the two hemispheres of the brain function, we mm-hmm. might find some framework in which to understand this.
Yes. We've got some ideas to go on from neuroscience. And the basic thing here is that to do anything well, we need both our left and right hemispheres. And yet what seems to be the case is that some of the time one hemisphere will inhibit the other one so that it can be dominant. And what we know from neuroscience and from Ian McGilchrist's work, Master and Emissary book, is that the left hemisphere is better at inhibiting the right hemisphere than the other way around. And there's a lot of things one can say, and Ian McGilchrist in particular says, in that sort of direction. In focusing, we pay attention inside in our bodies and to what we call felt sense. And I think from my reading of neuroscience, this is unquestionably a practice that draws us more into our right hemispheres. So if, for example, if we spend, people like you and I, these days spend a lot of our time when we're awake, inevitably using the focused attention of the left hemisphere. And when I say focus there, there's nothing to do with focusing. I mean, focused in the normal sense of the word, to write our emails, to deal with all the detail of our lives that we have to deal with, then we are probably inhibiting what our right hemisphere can contribute some of the time. And this leads us to a place where we say, maybe on a regular basis, I feel I need to reconnect with myself.
Mm-hmm.
Stop writing emails and looking at my mobile phone and attending to detail and trying to do this and trying to do that, and just go inside and take my time and see what's there. And in doing that, the balance shifts back to the right hemisphere. And the main thing that we know that is important here, relevant here about the right hemisphere, is that it's only the right hemisphere that really has a map of the body from the inside, the viscera, the organs, the sort of middle of the body that is particularly important in focusing. So that to know how I'm feeling in my body, I need to go to my right hemisphere and its mapping of my inner state to find that out. And that's involves a different kind of attention from my normal focused attention outside myself. It involves what I might call broad attention or global attention or open attention. And then different things come into my awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I'm focusing, I'm not looking at my computer screen or messing around with bits of paper or having a rapid conversation with somebody. I'm taking my time to do focusing.
So, Peter, is it okay?
Yeah.
I just want to maybe try and summarize what I'm hearing.
Okay.
And so what we're talking about is when in any form of mindfulness, we're talking about shifting attention. And shifting attention is not an abstract notion, but there are inner processes, inner neurological processes. And so, mm-hmm. for instance, when we pay attention to detailed work or to more intellectual work, like for could be email, could be something of that nature, there's a certain part of the brain that's going to be involved. Mm-hmm. And if we, on the other hand, shift our attention to another part of the brain, the right hemisphere,
yeah.
It is actually the circuits that enable us to be aware not just of abstract ideas, but actually to what's happening in our body. So we talk about in everyday language, just having a sense of curiosity about what's happening in our body, the simple fact of having that curiosity and looking for it allows us to switch the circuit and be more in the circuits of the right brain hemisphere, where that capacity to know what's happening in our body is possible.
That's right. And what happens there is that the left hemisphere doesn't go away, but its role rather changes. And the focused attention that the left hemisphere does is to pay attention to the more open attention style of the right hemisphere, and to get the two working together. So in focusing, that's the experience of just stopping, taking our time, sensing inside, seeing what comes. And then as we become aware of something inside, we become aware of a felt sense, as a felt sense forms in the way that Genlin talks about it, then our left hemisphere becomes aware of that, latches onto that. And then I think there's probably a lot of backwards and forwards between the two hemispheres and a process that is integrative of both sides of the brain happening.
Right. So that's a key part, because what you're describing is that the left hemisphere then becomes interested in interpreting the data of what's happening from the right hemisphere. And in that doing, there's a dialogue that goes there between that inner experience and the making sense of it in a left hemisphere kind of way, which allows for integration. Whereas if we shut off the right hemisphere, we're only functioning on data without the internal experience.
If we are doing a left hemisphere dominant activity, which my most frequent example is writing emails, of course there'd be millions more, then it may be that what our right hemisphere is doing just stays quite well out of awareness. And the right hemisphere is looking after the body, heart rate, breathing, digestion, blood flow, all this kind of stuff. And so it's there if we turn our attention inside to it, which is what we do when we do focusing. I stop looking at my emails and I take my attention inside to what's happening in my body. So then it's like left turns to right, and right has a chance to offer up what's going on there. And then left can take an interest in that. And we know that the left hemisphere does most of the work around language. So when we look for words to describe our felt sense, then the left hemisphere is cooperating with the right to find a good description, a good way to express, to put into language what I feel is happening inside me.
And so here we're finding the process of focusing in that dialogue between the felt sense and finding a handle with it, for it, and that back and forth. And we're essentially, you're seeing with this neuroscience perspective, focusing is essentially an integrative activity, because it allows for this back and forth that gives us that more rounded interaction with the possibility of interaction or making sense of the world.
We're hopefully making sense of our inner experience of the outside world and of our inner world.
I didn't mean making sense in the sense that it's objectively right. I mean, just in a way, we're trying to make sense in the sense of find our position and interact with the world. It allows us to process the information by using all of our processing capacity, as opposed to shutting out the right hemisphere.
So we often, in focusing, we often become aware of aspects of a situation and of our feelings evoked by that situation. We become aware of them that we weren't aware of before. And so focusing is very often a surprising experience. It's almost, you could almost think of it, though that's a hallmark of focusing. You have an experience and you think, wow, that's surprising. I didn't think I would find that inside. But it's typical when people do focusing, because their left hemisphere has just started including the right in a way that tends maybe not to happen so much in our busy lives, where we're trying to do and achieve all kinds of things every day.
So as in a way, so many discoveries, what we experience as new has always been there, but was not seen.
Yeah, yes, we could say that. And in terms of the felt sense, I think an interesting point here is that Gendlin always seems to be saying you have to wait for the felt sense to form. It's not just there when you turn your attention inside. You need to give it a few seconds, and then it forms. Now, I think from the neuroscience angle on this, what we say is that the felt sense actually is there already, and it's the natural territory of the right hemisphere. If the right hemisphere is in a happy state, in other words, it's not overwhelmed with emotion or in a traumatized state, then it will tend to have this holistic, bodily-centered sense of what's going on. And we call that the felt sense. So the forming, the little period of time in which Gendlin says the felt sense forms, is actually something to do with the left and the right hemisphere coming together and what's happening in the right hemisphere to come into the focused attention of the left hemisphere. And then we have it in awareness, and then we can maybe start to say something about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So actually, even the phrase you're using, you say the time for the right hemisphere to come into the focused attention of the left hemisphere, has for me a bit of that visual connotation of the act of focusing, you know, that Gendlin mm-hmm. discovers, as if you're having field glasses and you're adjusting the focus because you hadn't mm-hmm. been looking at that, and you're now need yeah. to actually look at it and adjust your yes. focus.
Actually, this is funny because don't tell Gene I'm saying this, please, but his description here is actually one from the left hemisphere. This is a left hemisphere view that the felt sense forms, and it's what he says, it's concretely there but conceptually vague. Well, that's from the left hemisphere's perspective. From the right hemisphere's perspective, it's what's there.
Right.
And the right hemisphere isn't bothered about there being anything conceptual about it. It's just what is. Mm-hmm. It's the sense of what is happening inside us that is inevitably completely linked up with what's happening outside of us in our environment, in the world around us. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but so in a way, it's yet another way to say that we spend much of our time apprehending the world through the left hemisphere, so yeah. that being in contact with the right hemisphere, even though it's always there, comes as a surprise.
It tends to come as a surprise, and normally a welcome surprise. And of course, focusing is one way we do it, but there are other ways. And for example, a lot of meditation practice, mindfulness practice would tend to go in the same direction. Going for a walk out in nature and stopping thinking about writing emails, for example, but just letting your mind go, looking at the sky and trees, that will tend to bring us back into a more balanced left-right state, I think. And we generally find that refreshing to do that. And sometimes when we do that, of course, we have, you go for a nice long walk and you're not worried about anything in particular, then maybe some fresh thoughts and feelings arrive, and you come back home and you feel refreshed, and you're looking at your life, maybe looking at the world slightly differently.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that also corresponds to the finding that, say, scientists will find their idea in their bathtub or in their shower, or the eureka moment can come, you know, in totally different circumstances, or generally yeah. that concept of thinking yeah. out of the box.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, people want to know how to do that, don't they? But it's the left hemisphere that wants to know how to do it. Mm-hmm. Give me the instructions for doing it. And then you have self-help books. And at the end of every chapter are a whole lot of step-by-step instructions about how to do an exercise. And that's to satisfy the left hemisphere.
Right.
Because these things really, they happen when they happen. And we have that very well in focusing. We let go. And I think a lot of learning focusing is about what we call trusting the process. And if we just hang out with our felt sense for long enough, something will come. And it does. And you don't need, this is the whole thing of, do we need instructions for how to do that? Or do we just set up the conditions that are conducive to that happening? And Gene says that very well, doesn't he? He says, well, here's some step-by-step guidelines if you want them, and if you don't want them, they don't fit for you, then forget about them and just do what feels right for you. Mm-hmm. So that's a very good way he has, I think, of allowing both our cerebral hemispheres to be involved, and we can sort of switch from sometimes somebody may want to approach it from a more, and need to approach it from a more left hemisphere point of view, but we also need to learn how to let go to the right hemisphere, and that's critically important. And when we do, something happens.
And so, you know, what we've been talking about is shifting in a way from that discussion that would be specific to people who know focusing or who are accustomed to the concept of felt sense, but to, in a more general way, understanding how we function to get a sense of how, what to do in the world. And that the neuroscience perspective is that it is sterile to just rely on the left hemisphere, and that shifting our focus to the right hemisphere allows us to have a more complete basis of information from which the left hemisphere can refocus on having a dialogue with the information as filtered by the right hemisphere in order to formulate, in a way, our response to the situation.
Yeah. It's like the way the brain has evolved is that we're meant to use the whole of our brain. Makes sense, doesn't it? But the way that our modern world has gone often makes use of this ability of the left hemisphere to inhibit the right, so that we can deal with a lot of detail, we can go quite quickly, we can rush through our tasks. In the modern world, we can deal with our computers and smartphones and everything we do with them. And arguably, this is taking us away from a more natural state where we would be using our whole brain all the time. And an example of that, for example, example of that I'd give is I enjoy sailing a lot, and often my wife and I would go on sailing holidays. So we had 3 weeks in Greece this summer, living on a boat and moving around on a boat. And in that sort of environment, I haven't done the scientific research to prove this, but it seems to me I'm using both sides of my brain in a way that in my normal working life back home, spending a lot of time with my computer, I'm not. And I really, really enjoy that experience of being out on the water with nature, with the elements, and having to use a lot of faculties of my mind to do it well and keep the boat safe and keep us safe and make it a good experience. So there's this urge for offers to probably for everyone in some way to get back into a more balanced psychological, neurological state, and people do all kinds of things to try to bring that balance back.
And so, yes, that the world we live in favors the bias toward using the left hemisphere. And there is a sense of intentionality, affirmative action, toward putting ourselves in circumstances where we make the effort to apprehend the world a little more through the right hemisphere so that the balance can be established. And it's not a balance that is just static in the sense of X amount of time in this, X amount in the other, but is actually by engaging the right hemisphere, we actually have a different functioning because then the left hemisphere is also involved and is also processing. So then that's where we have an integrative processing.
Now, I think an important thing to understand here is there are probably many, many ways in which we can have an integrative processing using the whole brain and both hemispheres. So focusing might be one practice that tends in that direction, but there are many, many other ways and things. And I like to think in terms of constellations. So there's certain typical constellations of left and right hemisphere I imagine get set up in the practice of focusing, and there are other constellations that will get set up in other activities. For example, focusing is a specific sort of practice that we normally do with a listener, and there are some quite clear guidelines about how to do this, and the role of the listener is quite prescribed. What they can do and what they're not going to do. We want our listener not to do a whole lot of things. Now, this may then give rise to one sort of left-right integration, and contrast that experience with sitting down with a good friend and having a rewarding, enjoyable conversation about whatever, but that sort of social engagement. Having a good chat with someone. That's going to be a different sort of constellation from left-right constellation from the focusing experience, because we're interacting with each other in a different way with, if you like, a different set of guidelines. But maybe both of them are capable of feeling quite rewarding and quite satisfying because we're engaging, particularly because we're engaging both sides of our brain. Yeah, so that makes sense.
So to be open to, in a way, that it's not just a one type of process, but different constellation, different neural networks, different activities, and we're going to have a lot of different variations where in each of these variations, we have the potential of actually having this balance between the two hemispheres. But I mean, since you're talking about conversation, I think it might be a good way to touch on something else, which is that the right hemisphere happens to also be a place where we're more prone to relating to others.
Ah, well, this is where we need to go into a little bit of the detail on it. So the picture from neuroscience is that our relating and communicating that we're aware of is quite based in the left hemisphere. So the left hemisphere, it generally actually quite likes to go out and find other people to interact with. It likes social engagement. It likes going to the party and meeting people and talking away with them. to do that in a way that is enjoyable, then it needs the support of the right hemisphere to do that. So we need our feelings and our bodily state to support our having an enjoyable social time together. And if the right hemisphere is very troubled with, for example, emotional, unresolved emotional difficulties, unresolved trauma, then this will detract from the ability of the left hemisphere to go out and enjoy the party. And so then maybe we don't want to go to the party. We want to stay at home. But all the time when say we're at the party and we're enjoying ourselves, our right hemispheres are looking after the aspects of relating and communicating that are less in our awareness. For example, our right hemisphere is keeping, my heartbeat and my breathing in sync with what is happening in our conversation. Because when I'm talking, I'm doing the talking, my heart rate and my breathing need to be rather different from when I'm listening to you. Mm-hmm. And my right brain takes care of that, and I don't have to think about it, do I? It just happens naturally. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. It's my right hemisphere that's going to pick up the situation that could happen where I'm doing a lot of talking and I think it's very interesting. What I'm saying is terribly interesting, but you're glazing over and getting bored. It's my right hemisphere that's going to pick that up. It's going to notice a bit of misattunement coming into the conversation. And you know, some people can get in a state where they don't notice that the other person's eyes glaze over and they just go on. But their right hemisphere will have picked something up. It's just that their left hemisphere is ignoring it. This is the way it seems to be. Mm-hmm. And then the whole business of the nonverbal communication. And what we're told is that the nonverbal communication is actually there's much more of it, and it's much richer than our verbal communication. Well, it's our left hemisphere generally that's looking after the verbal communication, but our right hemisphere in the background is looking after the nonverbals. And aspects of nonverbal communication are the tone of voice, the pacing of what we say, keeping the volume to the right level so the other person can hear us without us shouting at them. All the stuff of posture and gesture that goes with our speaking, and the sense of the meaning that is behind our words. Our words want to carry meaning and have a flow, and the right hemisphere is involved in that and in noticing the effect that what we say has on the other person. So I'm just now reminding myself that I've been speaking for a little while and to you, so I'm going to pause here for you to respond. So we practice what we're preaching. Practice what we're preaching.
Yeah.
I practice what I'm preaching.
So actually what I want to do is reflect not so much the detail of what you said, but overall sense of it, which was a sense of that beautiful moment-by-moment cooperation between these different functions. Mm-hmm. Because you're not in any possible way saying that one is more important than the other. And what really comes across is that interplay. And the exquisite interplay of this and that part, you know, and how it makes it happen to create that harmonious experience.
Yeah. Yes, and that wonderful that it all comes together, because if we had to think about how to stitch it all together, we would be in big trouble. We wouldn't be able to do it. Mm-hmm. But our brains and our nervous systems that include brain and body together are able to do that, and it's miraculous, and we take a lot for granted. And in going into the detail of what's happening, I find it fascinating, and there's a lot to be grateful for.
Yes.
that we're able to do quite naturally. And what we know, and particularly as if I'm a psychotherapist, I think you're a psychotherapist, is that a lot of problems actually arise for a lot of people. Because people, the people who come to therapy bring some problem in what you and I are talking about here. It's not working for them in a way that ends up leaving them feeling rewarded and satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big generalization, but it's a bit of a rule of thumb, if you like, with therapy.
And so we're talking in here about a sense of integration, not being some kind of an abstract concept of integrating ideas or integrating some abstractions, but the functioning of our organism as a whole, of our nervous system as a whole, where the different parts work together in that very smooth way. To create the whole experience and to allow us to have the capacity to process all of the information that allows us to function beautifully. You know, a human interaction is maybe the archetypal experience, as we're social animals, where a lot of our functioning and our most elaborate functioning is taking place. And that's a perfect way to see how it is made possible by this working smoothly.
That's right. Yeah. Like just this thing of my inner visceral state must be kept in tune all the time with what's happening in the conversation between us. And if it weren't in tune, then it would start to feel pretty funny and not very good.
Well, that's actually the stuff that comedy is made of.
Well, indeed, it plays. That's true. It plays on this. Things just going a little bit off from the center, the sort of perfectly integrated kind of norm or whatever. And you just pick it up, don't you? So you need your right hemisphere to pick up the incongruities that we start to laugh about. I think the comedy is a very good example. So sort of drawing some threads together here, because our time's coming towards a close, it really interests me that the felt sense is the natural territory of the right hemisphere. At the same time, all these implicit aspects of relating outwardly to other people are also the natural territory of the right hemisphere. And does one tend to lead to the other? So that's the question I'm raising, but my proposition, this proposition I wrote down around this question, is that the felt sense is not just about me. The felt sense is my sense of self and my sense of you, the other person, or my sense of myself, sense of self, and sense of the world I'm in. They go together in a way that is not distinguishable. It may seem to me like I can distinguish them, but in reality, inside, in my nervous system, in my brain, they're all bound up with each other.
Which,
does that make sense?
Which is very consistent with the idea that we don't exist in isolation.
Yeah.
Everything we do is in interaction of some form, not just interpersonal interaction, but we exist in an environment. You know, if there's no air, we don't live, you know, all this kind of stuff. So essentially that it's impossible to think of something that would be just us that's not in a way some kind of reaction, response, evaluation of where we are and how we are in response to where we are and what we interact with.
No, I'm not quite sure I've got you on that last point. Let me put it this way. Obviously, it's of advantage to us that we can take ourselves out of direct contact with other people sometimes. We can be on our own.
Mm-hmm.
To think our own thoughts, be with our feelings on our own without having to deal with somebody else. But the idea that we can manage on our own and we don't need other people is probably a complete illusion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit of a left hemisphere perspective, and we know that we need really that we need each other. We start from a point of relatedness, as you say, we're social animals, and then sometimes we withdraw to be on our own for a particular purpose. And hopefully that what we want is that withdrawing to be valuable rather than a kind of avoidance of life and living and other people and the world around us that sort of suggests something's not quite right.
But I'm hearing something more in what you said, which is, and maybe I'm hearing it because that's where I'm at, but I want to just say, I think what you were saying, something about the felt sense, is not just the sense of where I'm at, but it's a sense of me in that situation. And the sense of me in that situation, you know, cannot be split. It's only an abstraction to say, oh, I can have a sense of me. It's always a sense of me in that situation by nature. So, so I just want to double check whether we're in the same wavelength there or.
Yes, no, absolutely. The felt sense is, well, that's my proposition. The felt sense is really, my sense of myself and my sense of you, the other person.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of self implies sense of the other. And, maybe this raises interesting, questions for our focusing practice and, what we do with our focusing practice and how we interact with our listeners and, how we then, when we're not doing focusing as such, how we interact and listen and speak with each other and do things together as focusing people who are trying to be mindful of our felt sense.
And maybe also it just clarifies, you know, something that might seem like an abstract idea that, you know, the unfolding of the implicit. But that if the felt sense is a sense of me and you, or a sense of me in situation, then by definition, it's already action-oriented, because it's a grasping of the situation. That's, in a way, already trying to make a working hypothesis of the situation in terms of what to do next. Then there's no separation between, in a way, the something that could be described as a contemplative practice, like focusing and action.
Well, yes, and I think this raises the old debate that seems to have been around in the focusing world ever since I got into it, which is around 30 years ago. Do we need an action step in focusing? Mm-hmm. And some people seem to like action steps. I've never been very drawn to action steps, because what I've found is that my action is, it seems to me to be rather different after I have been focusing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
My focusing leaves me in a new place than my action changes of its own accord. Still, if some people want to use an action step, then great, because the thing with focusing, as we know, is a technique and a method, and it's not the technique and method in and of itself. It's the way that each of us uses that technique and method, what use we make of it,
mm-hmm.
how we apply it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably all kinds of ideas and variations there.
Great, great. Well, thanks, Peter.
This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.